May it please the Court. Your Honors, on February 20th, 2013, the probation court revoked Mr. Griffith's second term of probation, suspended execution of sentence, and purported to place him on a third term of probation. Mr. Griffith's probation was revoked again, that is a third time, on November 19th, 2014, and his sentence executed. Respondents concede, as they must, that the probation court had no authority to impose a third term of probation. The issue becomes, did the probation court have Section 559.036 authority to execute Mr. Griffith's sentence some 21 months after revoking his second term of probation? Under the plain meaning of that statute, the probation court clearly did not. To reach this conclusion, I ask the court to answer, for the first time, a simple question with profound implications. What does it mean to revoke a term of probation in the ordinary meaning of that word, codified in the plain language of Section 559.036? And more specifically, what happens to the probation court's authority to subsequently act after revoking a term of probation? To answer that question, I will ask the court to find that the ordinary meaning of revoke means to terminate and annul or cancel a term of probation, that the probation court authority to act ends when the second term is revoked, that the probation court exceeded its authority by revoking Mr. Griffith's second term and delaying execution for 21 months.
Well, they clearly would have had authority to impose a sentence at the time they revoked the second probation.
That's
correct? Doesn't terminate all authority. So how long a period does that last when the court can act to execute a sentence after the second revocation?
Well, I think there are a couple of schools of thought with that. One is that there's sort of this, what I would like to kind of think of as a unitary act theory, is that revocation and execution kind of go hand in hand. They're coterminous, and they have to happen at the same time. The other is the theory that's sort of adopted by the Western District's opinion in Brown versus Combs, that was sort of permitted a delayed disposition, delayed execution, so long as it was within a reasonable time. So those are sort of two schools of thought. Under the plain language of 559.036, I believe that statute suggests that act is always coterminous. It's always a foregone conclusion, and so therefore I believe that the execution is part and parcel of the revocation, happens at virtually the same time.
So the trial court would not have the authority to execute the sentence pursuant to 559.115, for example? Because then the trial court would have to retain jurisdiction.
That's true, and we're talking specifically about the second term of probation, and I think...
And that's my question. In the second term of probation, would the court then have no authority to execute the sentence pursuant to 559.115?
I think that's true, because the way the statute is written, it very clearly sort of narrows, funnels down the options available to the probation court as time goes on, and as additional terms of probation are granted, and that I think it very clearly leads to the fact that execution of a sentence is always compelled, is always a foregone conclusion when you get to the second term of probation.
But you could grant, you could reduce the sentence by the time that the person served on probation. There's lots of alternatives. So how do we know? When the court doesn't act, we don't automatically know and can't supply by law, you know, sort of by fiat, what would have happened, because we don't know what the court would have done. So how, as a practical matter, and Brown struggled with that, other cases have, how do we deal with that?
Well, I think it's important to remember first that mitigation is also a form of execution. It's really just execution with, you know, lessened to a certain degree.
Absolutely.
So I think that we have to presume that the trial court would have done this because it really had no discretion to do it at that point in time, but to execute the sentence.
But how does that inure to your client's benefit? I mean, how long a period does the court have, and what happens if the court doesn't perform that obligation?
I don't think it's necessary to even reach that question. If we accept this sort of unitary theory of revocation.
But the unitary theory, again, when the court revokes probation the second time, that's so they can execute sentence in the normal case. Mm-hmm. So they clearly have authority to execute. So when does that authority end? You say it certainly ends before 21 months, which we had here.
Sure.
do we have anything to help us gauge at what point that authority?
I think the plain language of the statute dictates that the probation court's authority ends as soon as it revokes. So revocation cuts it off. So again, at that point, anything that happens thereafter, I think is a nulli. There's no authority under the statute for the court to
act.
It
said they could execute, though, but they have to do it in the same order. Is that your position?
That is my position.
Okay.
But now your opponent argues that it must be completed by the end of the probationary term. Do you disagree with that?
I do, because I believe that once the second probation term is revoked, it essentially is not only terminated, but it's annulled, canceled. It's as if it never existed, because we're dealing with an order of probation in this case. And under the meaning of revoke, especially in the context of an order, a piece of paper, that has to be, you know, annulled at that point in time. So again, all to the extent that the length of probation is a condition of probation, any condition, any term of probation would also evaporate when that second probation term is revoked by the probation court.
But does the court still have authority during the entire period of the second term of probation?
No, because the statute clearly says that its authority to extends throughout the probation term only to revoke. And it has already taken the act of revoking here. There's nothing in the statute that says that it has authority to execute at any time during the probation term.
But they're actually completing the revocation proceedings. Is that a distinction?
I think that's a distinction, but again, only if it assumes that these are sort of two separate acts that don't belong together, that don't happen simultaneously, and that, again, you'd be dealing with a reasonableness calculus at that point in time.
What action did the court take when the court revoked the second term of probation?
When it revoked the second term of probation, it entered a revocation order, suspended execution of sentence, imposed a sentence of 5 years, and then also purported to place Mr. Griffith on a third term of probation.
Well, and where do you get that? Just out of curiosity, is that part of the transcript or just from the docket entry?
That comes from the docket entry.
Okay. Because there's no judgment that was entered imposing that sentence.
No, that is true. And I think that's one of the reasons why Brown is useful in this case, is because it supports the notion that you can look to the docket entries to determine the intent of the probation court in this case. Here, there was a very clear docket entry that said probation revoked, you know, third term of probation entered, suspended execution of sentence.
Did your client ask to be placed on that third term of probation after the revocation?
To my knowledge, no.
I know the probation order placing him on probation says you're referring to your client. Application for probation has been received and approved, mm-hmm. suggesting that it was requested, and then your client signed the probation order as well.
Sure. And if that's the case, clearly, the authority to grant terms of probation either exists or it doesn't under by operation of statute. There's nothing Mr. Griffith could have done to invite the court to exceed its authority.
But
in this case,
we've said invited error, even in probation cases, could
that's
suggest
true.
That that if you if your client invited this error, then they can't gain by contesting it at a later date.
That is true. And there's nothing in the record to show that Mr. Griffith requested a continuance to grant the court extended power. I think this is a completely distinct sort of situation, that even if he was consenting to probation to a third term, that doesn't automatically grant the trial court inherent power under 559-036 to place him on that term. There's nothing in the statute to say that it could. So again, it's a matter of power. It exists or it doesn't. And where Mr. Griffith, I think that I presume you're referring to the recent Miller opinion that dealt with the notion of invited error, that again, that dealt with the continuance issue, continuing past the end of the probation term. And here, there was a very clear order to revoke, so the term ended. And anything that really, if the trial court sort of went beyond what the statute said, again, that's sort of on its own, and Mr. Griffith cannot be said to have invited it in this case.
When was the defendant placed in the alternative court treatment program, and what are the circumstances of that?
That was, as pertaining to the revocation of the first term of probation, that occurred specifically on
October 6th,
2011, yes. The first term was revoked. A 5-year sentence was imposed, but the court retained jurisdiction under 559-115. And he was subsequently released on January 20th, and then the...
That was his second term of probation.
The second term of probation started in earnest on the February 3rd of 2012 at that point. So I would urge that as far as a remedy here, I think that that's where this court may get tangled up, but I think it's much more simple in this case than it might initially seem, and that is because Mr. Griffith would be entitled to relief under either sort of a unitary or reasonable sort of theory of execution of the sentence. The 5-year sentence he was under had run by February 19th of 2018. So had the probation court executed when he was revoked, if we just sort of go back in time and say that the sentence was executed on February 20th, 2013, under the sort of unitary act theory, again, he would be entitled to discharge. And it would always be unreasonable, I believe, for the probation court to wait 21 months to execute a sentence. And so under the sort of independent act, reasonableness calculus, Mr. Griffith would also be entitled to discharge here. I think this also comports with this court's precedent, which has interpreted the probation court excess of authority under 559-036 in Zimmerman, the 2017 case, and also Strausser, the 2014 case. The remedy there was discharge. And so these cases seem to suggest that where any excess of the probation court's authority under that statute should always result in discharge, and I think the result should in here as well. And if there are no further questions, I'll speak to the court on rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'd like to start by addressing Judge Stitt's question about how long the revocation execution, how long the court has authority. And that is clearly until the end of the period. That is what the Court of Appeals unambiguously held in Brown v. Combs, and it's what the statutes discuss if you read them in paramateria. 559-036 states that probation courts have the authority to revoke a probation term for the duration of the term designated by the court. Now, 559-016 defines that term as specific to the grade of offense, if it's a felony or a misdemeanor, and it says that the term shall remain conditional and subject to the revocation for that entire duration.
To support your argument, do we have to ignore the fact that the court revoked the second term of probation and did not order sentence to be executed?
I don't think the court needs to ignore that.
What's the effect? If it's already revoked, then there is no continuing term of probation in which to later revoke probation.
And this touches on a point that I think Judge Russell raised, is that the revocation wasn't complete until the sentence was executed. A revocation is not a one-stop shop. It's not like termination where you just end the probation
but
term early.
When the court revoked the second term of probation, the court found that Mr. Griffith did not need to be incarcerated and did not need to have his sentence executed at that time. So the court entered an order of revocation and made the determination, factual and exercising discretion, that sentence should not be executed. So don't we have to ignore that to subsequently say the court didn't exercise its full authority and can later act?
Well, and this gets into the difficulty that I think Judge Stith mentioned was the Brown court encountered. How do you know what the court was going to do, what they intended to do?
Well, we know the court didn't revoke probation, so we don't have to speculate what the court was going to do.
Well,
the
correct.
Court found probation didn't need that if he placed him on another term of probation, the court, in effect, found he didn't need to be incarcerated.
At that time, the court, probably believing that it could continue him on a third term probation, entered that order. Now, that part of the order was error, and it's void under Brown v. Combs.
But so we should find that the court would have executed the sentence But for because the court had no other choice, and therefore, even though the court ruled contrary to that, we should allow the court subsequently to execute the sentence?
No. You don't need to find that the court would have executed on February 20th, 2013, because the court continued to have authority for the duration of the second probation term.
Before you abandon that lifeboat, what else could the judge lawfully have done?
At that point, the judge could have continued the probation, the second term.
But he didn't. He revoked it. So he's finished writing the sentence, revoked, period, and now what is he lawfully authorized to do?
So at that point, the judge could decide either to execute sentence or mitigate that sentence by the time served on probation. And under Brown v. Combs, and I think the plain language of the statutes, the court has the full duration of the term to decide, make that decision.
And he can just leave the defendant in limbo that entire period, revoked but not revoked.
Well, they are revoked. At least there was a finding of
a violation.
And so
what are they doing during this time? If they're revoked, they're not on probation anymore, right? And yet he was subjected to the terms of probation during that time. Well, he wasn't imprisoned. He had a status that doesn't exist.
If they are revoked, they're still on probation until the sentence is executed. And there was a hearing held.
Well, that's
at least
the question we have to decide today.
Correct.
And tell us why that's the answer.
So there was a hearing, or at least he had the opportunity to have a hearing in this case. I think Mr. Griffith waived the hearing and admitted the violations. So there's no due process issue here. There were violations, and Mr. Griffith violated the terms of his probation, and his probation could have been revoked and executed based on those violations.
But it wasn't. I understand. But it was not executed. You're saying for 21 months, everybody agrees, right?
Correct.
So it could have been, but it wasn't. So what was his status during that interim period? Was he on the second term still, even though the court had revoked that term?
He was still on the second term.
So that order was ineffective, didn't have any effect of revoking his probation?
The order had the effect of finding the violations.
I understand.
Yes.
So my question goes back to, we have to engage in a fiction to get where you are arguing we should go. We have to then ignore the fact that he imposed the third term and that he subsequently revoked the third term, because it isn't as though he revoked it and then waited 21 months to impose sentence. That's not what happened. So to reach the conclusion that he can revoke the second, or he can impose order execution of sentence at the end of the 21 months, we have to ignore that he intended to put on the defendant on probation, actually ordered an illegal probation, and then subsequently held a hearing to revoke.
I think the court does have to ignore the court's intent, because the question is of the probation court's authority. The probation court had authority for the full second term, and so the revocation proceedings needed to be completed before the term was ended.
Don't we need to look at both the court's authority and what the court intended to do?
Not in this case.
And why not?
Because the myriad of probation cases that this court and the Court of Appeals have decided in the recent years have not focused necessarily on the probation court's intent, but on what the court had authority to do under the statutes. Say X. Rel. Zimmerman v. Dolan. Judge Dolan in that case clearly intended to revoke Mr. Zimmerman's probation, but didn't take the necessary actions to retain that authority. So it wasn't the intent that was relevant in that case. Same thing with the cases dealing with restitution. The courts.
But when there's no authority, that makes sense that you don't look at intent. When there is authority, why would you not look at intent?
I don't think it's relevant, I suppose, but it's not dispositive. Clearly, the court intended him to remain on probation at the time because it believed it had authority to enter the third term. Now, that calculus may have been different if the court realized that the third term probation order was void, and so that's why it becomes difficult to examine the court's intent. Now, I think another threat underlying this issue is the court's uncomfortableness with the probationer remaining on probation after the revocation, but then ultimately being revoked. I think Judge Stith described it as being in limbo for the 21 months. And if the court believes that the probationer obtains some sort of due process right or liberty right after the initial revocation order is entered, then the remedy is just to order another hearing. And that's what happened in this case. Mr. Griffith had another hearing 21 months later where he again admitted violating the conditions of probation, didn't bring up the issue of a third probation, and just asked the court to continue him on probation again. But the court realized that enough was enough, and he could not continue to leave him on probation. So here there's been everything that the court did was something that it had authority to do. If the court entered an order for a continuance instead of an order for a revocation, then we wouldn't be having this discussion. Because
a continuance of 21 months would be rather long. But let's play this out. Let's say you're absolutely correct, and the court can only at this point have a hearing and possibly mitigate, right? So if he mitigates by 21 months of this so-called limbo probation that he's still on, what's his out date?
The out date would be the end date of the probation term.
But if you mitigate the 21 months back.
Right.
Oh, you mean Mr. Griffith specifically? I haven't done that calculation, so I can supplement the record if the court would like me to. But
I'd like to see that.
Okay. I will say, though, that his probation time wasn't credited with time for served non-probation, as my recollection of the record is. So I don't think that would actually affect his out date now.
You're saying he shouldn't get credit for the 21 months?
But
the probation time credit towards service of the sentence is discretionary with the probation court. Here, the probation court didn't order that time credit applied to Mr. Griffith's
sentence. But if we order a separate hearing to determine what that should be, that's the question. Could the court do it then? And what would that outcome be if the court could do it then?
Yeah, throughout the second term probation, the court does have authority, at least until it executes sentence, to mitigate that sentence with the time credit. So in that situation, then Mr. Griffith's sentence would have been reduced by all the time he served on probation, for any term, for his
and
first
he would
and
be
second
out,
term.
And he would have been out before the third, before his sentence was executed.
No. The final expiration date for Mr. Griffith's probation was, I believe, because the second term
2018
was in 2018 or 2017.
But if you subtract
that. Was put on probation for the second term according to the statement of facts, on February 3rd of 12.
Yes.
So if you add 5 years to 12, that would be 17. The court didn't extend it for a one-year period. So how could he be held beyond that date?
On probation? He could not be held on probation beyond the February
2017. But the court couldn't have acted on probation beyond the February 3rd of 12.
No, beyond February 3rd of 2017.
But the court executed sentence in 2014, is that right?
Yes. The actual execution sentence was November 19th of 2014, well inside the second probation term period.
Right.
So that's not an issue in this case. And the probation time credit wouldn't apply to the probation term, but it would apply to his ultimate sentence of incarceration in Department of Corrections.
Right.
My remaining time, if there's no further questions on the merits, I'd like to address a couple points as to the statute of limitations. In his reply brief, Mr. Griffith discussed that the statute of limitations would be unconstitutional if applied to a habeas case. But this court in Wigglesworth v. Weyrich has held that the exercise of the power of habeas corpus is subject to valid rules of practice and procedure as are enacted by the General Assembly or are adopted by this court. As Mr. Griffith admits in his reply brief, statute of limitations are procedural. And Article 5, Section 4 doesn't confer an absolute right to seek any writ in any court. It just confers the power on all appellate courts to issue and decide original remedial writs. This also would not be an unconstitutional suspension of the writ, because this court also in Wigglesworth has held that suspension is an absolute denial of the ability to seek to investigate into the cause of detention.
People get out on habeas 20 years after the crime when evidence comes. You're saying that statute of limitations would preclude that?
The one-year statute of limitations would apply to those cases, barring anything that would excuse that, but it does apply.
And we have applied that in habeas and said you're barred from bringing in habeas?
This court has not applied the statute of limitations in a habeas case.
And are you aware of any court, like U.S. Supreme Court, federal courts that have done so?
Yes, actually, the federal court system has a one-year statute of limitations that is regularly applied in habeas cases and has been held to be constitutional in multiple circuits. And additionally, there's at least 14 other states There's at least 14 other states.
They consider habeas cases brought in federal court that have arisen in state court many, many decades earlier. There's a one-year period in which you can take certain actions in federal court, but the person may have been incarcerated for 5, 10, 20, 30 years, and they're not barred from seeking relief.
That's not entirely accurate. The federal one-year statute of limitations starts counting from the date that the conviction is final, which would be the conclusion of direct review. Now, it can be told during state post-conviction proceedings, but 30 years later, I don't know how any state post-conviction proceeding would last for over 29 years. I suppose it's possible, but as to the... Sorry, was there a second part of that question?
No, go ahead.
Okay. There is at least 14 states that have an explicit year limitation on bringing habeas statutes, and I can supplement the record with those statutes if the court would like. Several other states provide that habeas corpus petitions must be brought within a reasonable time. So this is not unusual or unconstitutional by any sense.
A Brady claim would be barred even though the information was hidden for 15 years, you'd say too bad? And isn't that inconsistent with our many cases recognizing such claims?
The statute of limitations would apply to that claim. Now, whether or not the person would obtain relief is another question. Barring any exceptions to a statute of limitations, there's certainly the possibility of executive clemency, and there's also the notion of justice. I mean, habeas is about justice, obviously.
It is indeed.
And if somebody brought a valid claim for relief, the Department of Corrections and the Missouri Attorney General's
office
would.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel, before you get started, I'd like for you to address the issue. And I understand your argument about the probation and what the court's power to do after revocation is. But so you're saying your argument would be is that the trial court had no authority even to stay the execution after the revocation of the second term of probation, even if the court didn't impose a third term of probation.
That's correct.
But I guess, and the reason I'm asking this, because it's not unusual, for example, for someone to execute a sentence, for a trial court to execute a sentence and order the defendant to show up to jail a week later, 2 days later, after they get their affairs in order. So you're saying the court cannot do that?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is the court would have to enter that order at the time it revoked, and that did not happen on this record. So I think it's reasonable to do that.
But the court can stay the execution then?
Well, I mean, yes, to the extent that they are actually ordering execution at the time that they are revoking. And I think that's the important distinction here, is that there was no order of execution that has to happen under the statute.
Is there a case you cite for that unitary principle that you're asking us to adopt?
No, it's just through the plain reading of the statute. I don't think there's any real other way to sort of interpret. Like I said, there are two ways to interpret the statute. And I think that's one way. That's maybe the most austere way of sort of viewing it. But I think as the Brown court recognized, there's also a secondary way. But again, I don't think the court needs to reach that precise issue here. I think this court can decide this issue without reaching that specific question or holding one way or the
other. It seems rather routine for me for a trial court, say it's the first term of probation and there's a violation, to hold a hearing, to find that the violation has occurred, but then not enter at that point a decision as to whether to continue or revoke. Would you agree that that's fairly common?
Absolutely.
And the trial court has authority to do that?
Absolutely.
So what's different about this? If in order to, at the end of the second term, all the trial court has authority to do, if it terminates or revokes, is to execute the sentence or execute the sentence with a mitigation, correct?
That's correct.
Well, until the court does all of those things, A and either B or C, it hasn't completed the process any more than a trial court completes the ordinary revocation process by finding both a violation and a decision on what we're going to do about it, right?
That's true.
So it seems to me that that's where the trial judge was when he revoked the second term, was halfway through the process of revoking and executing or executing with mitigation. And that decision was never made. The trial judge never decided which of those two options should be applied until the third term was revoked.
That's true. And I think the decision is already made for the probation court under the statute because they've already imposed a sentence. All that remains is to execute it. It's almost like a ministerial perfunctory act.
No, because there's the discretionary decision of whether to mitigate it.
That is true.
So if that were not possible, this would be an easy case because the trial court would be deemed to have done the only thing the trial court could do. But we're stuck here because there was an opportunity to exercise discretion that neither you nor the state ever pointed out to the trial court. The trial court was obligated to consider, correct?
That's true. But again, you know, I think the respondents want to make a distinction between sort of the violation and say this is sort of like a censure or a sanction sort of issue. But a finding of a violation, as you say, is a routine practice. And then the acknowledgement is that the revocation happens later as a final disposition. And that is that at that point where all of those things are supposed to happen at the same time.
What was the final disposition here?
Well, the final disposition ultimately was that my client was sent to prison in November of 2014.
Or the final disposition after the court revoked the second order of term of probation was that the court entered an illegal order or an unauthorized order.
That is true as far as suspending.
The court actually acted. The court just erroneously acted.
It acted erroneously, and it acted under color of no authority under the statute.
If it had revoked, what would have been the outdate if it had actually mitigated all the probationary term?
By my quick calculations, and I'm not a math major or anything, but somewhere in the neighborhood of May 19, 2016. If it had been executed anticipated on February 20th of 2013. And if there are no further questions, I ask that this court issue a permanent writ of habeas corpus ordering Mr. Griffiths immediate discharge from respondent's restraint.
Thank you.